Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi, and Augustin Macellari.
On this week's show, documentary maker Adam Curtis and choreographer Rosie Kay. They'll be talking through their dance production, MK Ultra, inspired by conspiracy theories and half-truths.
We'll also be meeting musician Barry Adamson, whose work ranges from the post-punk Off magazine to film soundtracks, and a stint as a bad seed in between.
And we'll be exploring the power of memory with authors and sisters Hilda and Ylva Ersby. They'll be discussing their book Adventures in Memory later in the show.
Plus, the unforgettable Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking at some of next week's news, and we'll have music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Well, Augustin, nice to be in the studio with you. It's been a busy week here at Midori House once again, hasn't it?
We better get on with it, hadn't we?
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's hear now from Fernando Augusto Pacheco. There was something. Fernando, welcome.
Hello. I always feel very nice being here on the Monocle Weekly. My first story is related to self-pampering yourself. It's China's Singles Day today, and is the biggest world's shopping spree. I mean, much bigger than Black Friday, Cyber Monday, or whatever you want to call. It's been happening in China since 1993, but the interesting thing here is the Chinese group Alibaba, they're also doing bricks and mortar, so it's not only online shopping. So they're creating a lot of experiences, you know, where people can go to the shop, buy exclusive products. I think it's a fantastic idea from China. If you're single, you know, just buy something that you like. I think every day should be a singles day. Spend or whatever you like.
Spend a pain away.
You know, I'm curious. You mentioned there are some exclusive products for singles day in China. Do you have any examples of what you can buy over there?
Well,
now?
I haven't seen, but Marcus, if you look at the offering of Alibaba, basically whatever you want. And this smartly take me to the second story. Because on Tuesday, well, even though, yeah, it wouldn't be exactly on Singles Day, but never mind, you know. On Tuesday, Michelle Obama is releasing her new memoir, Becoming. I do miss her. She was one of the most iconic and influential first ladies. And, you know, I think I'll be buying myself a copy of Becoming. And she's also going on a world tour of her book. She's also coming to London, but tickets are sold out, of course. I think there was more than 50,000 people on the queue to buy the tickets. I think it would be an interest read. And I have to say, I mean, I mentioned that I usually wouldn't read a book like this, but I remember when Valérie Trévaille, she released her book, that was quite actually outrageous, you know, the things she was saying about François Hollande. But it was also a good read. But yeah, certainly Michelle Obama's Becoming will be a different type of book as well.
Who would you like to see release a book?
Well, Marcus, I think this might not come as a surprise to you, but I'm really hoping that the Brazilian former president Dilma Rousseff should write a book and tell all the story of the behind the scenes of the impeachment. Also, Argentina's former president Cristina Kirchner, or even Merkel. You know, she said that she's leaving the command of the CDU. I think when she ends that, I think she should write a book, and I would definitely go and buy it.
Why not? Where are we going next?
We're staying in the world of film. We are getting into the award season slightly. So on the 16th of November, this Friday, we'll have the nominations for the Spirit Awards, which is kind of the award independent cinema. It's interesting about the Spirit Awards because every year, you know, the award show is one day before the Oscars, and the industry saying that, you know, if you want to know who is going to be nominated for the Oscars or who is going to even win, you should look at the Spirit Awards because the Oscars have been nominating more and more independent films. So for example, last year, they awarded Get Out, Call Me By Your Name, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which ended up having a few accolades on the Oscars night as well. So it's becoming a very important, award show.
I was just going to ask about all these awards. Do you think all of them are necessary, or do you think there are some award ceremonies, awards there that don't really deserve the attention they get?
I think we have too many of them, but I don't think the Spirit Awards is one of them. I think the Spirit Awards is very much respected, as are the Golden Globes, but I mean, you are right. There are, I think, 10, 15 award shows. I think we can at least cut at least 5 of them. But I wouldn't cut the Spirit Awards. And I wonder who's going to be nominated. I put my bets on The Favorite, the new dark comedy by Yorgos Lanthimos. I actually have seen this film at the London Film Festival. Excellent. Olivia Colman, she's just brilliant in it. And I'm sure she will get a Best Actress a nomination for that.
Is that the one who directed The Lobster?
Yes, that's the one.
I will not be watching that.
Well, it's a very different film from The Lobster. take my recommendation.
If you had to put down £100 now, which film for you is going to get the most awards?
It's a very difficult one, but everybody's talking about Green Book, which is a buddy road trip with Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali. You know, apparently people are saying it's funny, it's going to be the surprise of the night. So yeah, I'll bet £100 on this one.
Thank you, Fernando. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be talking tunes with Barry Adamson.
Manchester-born musician Barry Adamson's career stretches from the birth of punk to international rock stardom. As a 17-year-old, he took up the bass for Manchester post-punk's magazine and has gone on to play in legendary bands such as The Birthday Party with Nick Cave in the 1980s, and later reuniting with Cave in recent years with The Bad Seeds.
He's also in the time being crafting a steady stream of solo albums and film soundtrack work. You can hear Barry Adamson across the scores from filmmakers ranging from Danny Boyle to Oliver Stone and David Lynch.
Barry is now collecting a small handful of some of his work in a new compilation, Memento Mori, Anthology 1978 to 2018. And he's here with us now to talk about it, as well as his many other projects. Barry, welcome. At what point did you start kind of writing your own work and thinking that you might want to put it out as an album?
Well, it's funny. Really early on in magazine, I had to sort of like, we'd finish the sessions and everyone would go to sleep, and I'd sort of do that thing where you can wake up in the middle of the night and creep back into the studio. It was the first opportunity I got to sort of play on other people's instruments and sort of just turn the keyboards on and sit at the drums and all this stuff. So I used to make these little cassettes of themes, like little strange tunes, and I just sort of kept them as a kind of library. But it was only many years later that I sort of put two and two together that I was creating some sort of strange film score world. So that's when I went ahead with it, really.
If we trace back to the very beginning, I love the story how we learned to play the bass overnight for magazine. How did that happen?
Well, certain things sort of, they're like a kind of call to arms, you know, and you sort of have to trust that that's the right thing for you, even though it would seem that you don't have a map or know where you're going or anything like that. So when a friend said to me, I've got a bass with two strings on it, do you want it? I said, yes, sure. Then the next day I was buying the other two strings and saw the advert for magazine. I didn't have an amplifier or anything, so I went home and lent the neck of the guitar on the bed because it would vibrate and make sound. So I stayed up all night. Then the next day went to the audition and I was shown a song called The Light Pours Out of Me, which I figured if you just play one note all the way through in a certain rhythm, it sounds great, which is what I did. And then Howard Devoto turned around to me and said, you've got the job. So then I really had to learn after that. But I had, you know, I was in good company to sort of road test all the ideas.
I love that story as well. And it kind of says a lot to me about the vitality of punk and that time.
That's the license as well. Right. I probably couldn't have done it under any other circumstances. Because I remember going to see the band Howard was in before, the Buzzcocks. And I was like sat at the bar with the guitarist, not knowing it was the guitarist. And he just like finished his drink and went on stage. There was no dressing room or anything like that. So all the formality had gone out of it. And his guitar was sawn in half. He just had like the neck and a bit of the guitar. So it was like all the rules were suddenly out the window.
Is musicality way more important now than maybe it was then?
In what sense?
Well, in the sense that, as you say, you're in this environment where people could play. It was more about creativity than musicality.
I think what's good now is that there's access to everything. Like I say, you know, there I was in the middle of the night switching on all these analog instruments to try and make a sound, where you can pull your phone out now. I write many a song on the underground just because the software and the technology is accessible. So I think now for people, if you want to create, you can create on the fly and you just do it. You know, you don't have to have a particular situation or circumstance that's going to push you. You just have to reach in your own imagination. I think everything's there. So I think that's pretty amazing these days.
What kind of memories do you have from 1970s or 1980s Manchester? You grew up in Moss Side and Manchester, during that era was famous worldwide for its music scene.
I mean, you would literally walk down the street and bump into Joy Division and say, you know, what are you doing? And they say, go and rehearsal. What are you doing? Go and rehearsal. See ya. That's it. And there's a film by Anton Corbijn called Closer. He captures the spirit it's incredible. I mean, it literally was in black and white. That's how I remember it even. And that there was like three people on the street at any time. There was no crowds. There was no. It was very quiet. And the atmosphere that he connotated to in that film is absolutely perfect. And it very much was like that, you know. And you were inspired by the people around you as well.
How do you explain why all that happened in Manchester?
I really don't know. I think there's a great sort of almost slightly grandiose self-importance there, born of a kind of spirit post-industrial. It's sort of portrayed in the way humour is conducted amongst people. You know, the way I was teasing you mercilessly before we started is a very Manchester way of being, you know. And there's a sort of like, we can do, you know, we're up north, but we can do this. And very much once the Sex Pistols came out there, things were happening in the punk era up there, even at the same time. You know, it's like that thing of, I think it's called anamorphic resonation, when a sparrow dips its beak in a bottle of milk in the south, and a sparrow in Aberdeen does the same thing at the same time. So I think it's pretty much something like that.
I wanted to ask a bit about your sort of interdisciplinary practice, because you spoke elsewhere about how another sort of great thing about contemporary creative technologies is that it allows you to kind of have this polymathic kind of output and work across all different things. And you spoke about some of your songs coming out of, you know, looking at photos of gigs, playing along with that. I'm interested about in how that kind of visual and sonic communication happens. And I guess it's something that must also play out in your soundtrack work.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I've always seen music as a visual element. That sounds strange, but I think I always link it to even that sort of example I was saying about Joy Division and the fact that the picture, if you like, was in black and white. Instantly, that gives us an idea, a sort of mood of how that must have been. We can hear things in a different way. So I've always been very much attracted to that as an idea. And I think there's a sort of an emotional link as well. I think that music is like the third component in a film. And I think very much pictures as well. You project your own experiences and everything else onto them. And for me, that became musical, even as a young boy. It was a way to sort of, not sort of get out of reality, but it was like an added reality to me.
How do you think you have evolved as an artist over the last, say, four decades?
Yeah, I think experience brings about a certain knowledge, which brings about a certain confidence in what you do. So I don't second guess so much. I feel pretty much that when I sit down to work, I know what I'm going to do. I know how it's going to go. I'm also, of course, remaining open to anything that comes in. But I think as an artist, I think that's how you develop. And you have this sort of experience and knowledge, and then you're there.
What do you think have been the biggest lessons? What kind of advice would you give to your 20-year-old self?
There were times in my 20s that were pretty difficult. I kind of fell over a lot. I had to pick myself up a lot. And I think I would use the advice of Winston Churchill, if you're going through hell, keep going. And you do eventually come out the other side. You know, and all of those experiences you can then bring to the table as well, I think, as art, as what you do, as expression, as sort of understanding, as communication.
You've worked with some really incredible collaborators, which must also have kind of contributed in the same way that anyone in a creative industry working with anyone else learns. You learn from one another.
Exactly.
The two that stand out for me are Nick Cave and David Lynch. Mm. And I wanted to ask about David Lynch just because I know he also makes music, quite weird music.
Yeah, it's true.
Have you been brought in ever to collaborate on that?
No, it's like an area that he's very sort of... I think he separates the two things, really. So he kind of trusts people to come in and, you know, he's got so much work on the film, but he has a vision. And, I mean, it's amazing for me, really. I mean, it's not often you get invited to a masterclass, which it kind of was, really. I did learn an awful lot, you know. I had ideas about music in film, but he would fine-tune certain things and sharpen them up and say, OK, you've got it, but what you have to do to give it the extra thing is, say, for example, in a scene between two people having a conversation. He said, don't listen to what they're talking about, but watch their eyes. And I started to do that, and right from there. And then he'd screen that scene, say, for example, that night in a theatre with an invited audience and call me up and say, you could hear a pin drop. You know, so he's working on these levels I didn't even understand before. it was like a kind of masterclass, same with Nick as well, to watch him in full kind of flow, writing and rewriting like some demented Beethoven, scratching out the note, putting the note back, scratching out the note, putting the note back, and ending up with the same note. It's kind of thrilling, and it's sort of saying to you as well, go where you need to go to achieve whatever you want to achieve. Just go, push.
And on that, with Nick Cave, his lyrical world, right, is kind of part of this huge and amazing narrative that he's been weaving together throughout his career. Yeah. How does that play into your lyric writing? Have you learned from that?
I've observed it, and I've stood back from it, and I've kind of internalised some of those ways to report for myself. I'm a different character. I'm a different observationalist, you know, and I sort of report on the human condition, if you like, using myself as a sort of experiment in a total other way. But there are sort of like forms, and perhaps like I've kind of gleaned or tried to glean an idea from him about poetry and how there's a poeticness to everything, and therefore look for that, and that will be the strength in the work rather than, you know, something that's linear and sort of on the nose, if you like.
It's always amazing to hear how these kind of collaborations work. I'm wondering, if you could choose, who would you like to work with? Who would be your ideal collaboration partner?
Well, I've been very fortunate in that I've worked with a lot of people that I've admired, from Iggy Pop through to David Lynch and Nick and Howard DeVoe, you know, so I've been a bit spoiled, I think. So I don't sort of sit around going, oh, I'd like, you know, I kind of like the sort of avenues that I'm taken down. I remember once quite arrogantly saying to somebody, they said to me, oh, you want to do film? Who do you want to work with? I went, let's see, Oliver Stone, Quentin Tarantino, David Lynch. You know, and I listed off these people. And they looked at me to say, like, you've just started in film. You know, how dare you even assume those things? And they all happened. I mean, I wish I was like that now, because, you know, I kind of censor it and go, well, no, you don't want to think like that. You know, that's sort of getting, you don't want to get ahead of yourself, you know. But that actually happened, and you can believe you probably can create these things. But
exactly. Is that the lesson to be learned, that you actually have to think big and be really ambitious?
Maybe. I still have a part of the Manchester kid that sort of goes, oh, no, don't do that, mate. Who do you think you are? You know, don't get too big for your boots. But this was kind of a natural thing, because it's what I really wanted to do. You know, and then lo and behold, you know, I get a call. And then I see Oliver Stone on TV going, I've just used 3 tracks from Soul Murder. It's great. And this sort of stuff. You know, he's on a Quentin Tarantino film. Then I'm sort of sidelined by hip surgery in a wheelchair. And I get a call from David Lynch saying, I've just been listening to your music for 10 hours straight. You know, and I'm like, what? So, and that was like a silver lining of a very dark cloud.
That's a great call to get.
What was it like performing with Iggy Pop?
It was great, actually. It was a little highlight there. I remember in Paris, we'd finished the show, and I said to him, so what are we doing for the encore? And he turns around to me and goes, dog, fun, eye. And I just thought, this is kind of incredible. I'm going to go out now and play. Now I want to be your dog. No Fun and TVI. And three of the greatest like rock songs ever written. Just to say them like that was just, and I just walked out there and there's like, I don't know, 10,000 people or something. And it was like, ding, 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 and you're in. It's a wonderful moment. And then Tina Weymouth from Talking Heads was backstage. And she came up to me and rather sort of trippily said, made the motion of playing the bass and just looked at me and said, I didn't know. whatever that means. But
I just wanted to ask a few things about this album. First of all, the songs, some of them have really leapt out, and I kind of wanted to know a bit more about the 007 Fantasy Bond theme.
Yeah.
Where was that coming from?
Sarcasm, I suppose. I'd heard a story that Monty Norman was walking on the beach of Jamaica, and there was a little ska group playing, and one of them was playing acoustic guitar and going, dun, diddle, dun, dun, dun. And he walked over and said, I'll give you $200 for that piece of music. And they went, yeah, Martin, give me the 200, no, like that. And then it became this Bond theme. So I was again, arrogantly sort of, well, what would that have been like had that have sort of filtered through to the mainstream? So that's why I did it that way. And then I got a very sort of, how should we put it, terse letter from the Monty Norman group and a horse's head in the bed.
In case there's trouble or we're under attack, have no fear, because Bond is black.
Live, you've been doing some gigs. Is it something that you love, performing live?
I do. I mean, you know, it's a different discipline. Again, there is that sort of show busy sort of thing. And that communication with an audience, which is very direct, you know, you don't sort of go, okay, someone's bought a record and they're listening to it now. You see the result of the work right there before you. Both shows were really successful. I was really pleased the way that the record's been received as well. It is something I'm more into than I kind of realise, actually.
Has it become an itch that you need to scratch more?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
So your compilation, Memento Mori, Anthology 1978-2018, is out now. I'm wondering, was it hard for you to go through all that material and try to figure out what you actually want to include?
Yeah, I was looking for Memento Mori 2 and 3, because that's a small selection across 10 albums and the other things that I've done as well. But I sort of like thought, I had an idea to present it like a new piece of work for somebody who's never heard my work before. And so hopefully there's a sort of ride as you listen to the tracks and then flip, if you're listening on the vinyl, for example, you flip it over and then the next thing kind of takes you further on another part of the journey. So I tried to do it a little bit like that and mix it up a little bit rather than like 78, 79, you know. So it had hopefully a broader interest.
And what's next for you? What's keeping you busy at the moment?
God, I can't get a moment at the moment. Producing a Swedish band called The Weeping Willows, possibly working on a score quite soon, and I've got my own new album in process. So between those three projects and some remixing as well, I don't really stop.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Barry.
And
as we said, the album is out now. And since we've been just talking to the man, this is, of course, Barry Adamson from his new collection, Memento Mori. This is The Long Way Back Again.
That was The Long Way Back Again by Barry Adamson. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. We'll be exploring the power of memory after this. Now, what makes us remember? Why do we forget? And what exactly is a memory?
Those are just some of the questions raised in the new book, Adventures in Memory, written by Norwegian sisters Hilda Ørstby and Ylva Ørstby.
Hilda is a successful novelist and journalist, and Ylva is a neuropsychologist. They have teamed up to deliver a book that uses clinical experiments, dramatic experiences, and a playful tone to reflect on what memory is and how it works. Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to Hilda and Ylva to learn more.
In science, you can describe memory in all the scientific general terms, but we all experience memory as this very individual experience, and it's very connected to that moment and that object and that person. So we try to approach memory from all angles, both this academic way and also from the story side of it, and using Proust and Shakespeare. And but also it was very important to write a book about memory as a good read, as a good story. Because what we know is that is how we remember stuff. So if we didn't use everything we knew about memory to write a memorable book, then we would kind of have lost the point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And coming back to the scientific academic side of the research that's gone into this, memory is such a completely intangible thing. It can mean one thing to one person and another to a completely different person. One of the things that I was really interested in is this concept of cumulative memory, where you feel like you remember, say, the example you give of taking the bus like 1,000 times, but really you don't really ever remember like one instance of it. You remember the feeling of sort of having done it a lot, and you categorize that as a memory, but really it's something. It's a sort of collage of many, many trips on that bus. Ylva, are memories tangibly traceable back to one source and you pick them out of your brain, or are they always just bodged together by the brain every single time you conjure one?
I think it is not tangible in the way that you can trace one specific memory experience to these and these and these memory traces in your brain. But you do have some memory traces, that is, the physical manifestations of a memory being formed in your brain, but your memory is so much more than the reactivation of those specific memory traces. So we add on a lot of detail, which is otherwise just either forgotten or just crammed into that cumulative memory. In that way, we save a lot of space in our brains, and we get to use our imagination to make the memory come alive again. So, yeah.
But it doesn't mean that all those cumulative memories are kind of always boring. It can also be, like, I remember kind of one of my childhood summers as just the summer with no rain. And it's just this continuous feeling of just lying in the grass and looking at the sky. Mm. And that's a nice cumulative memory, right? A collected memory like that.
So or the memory of just cuddling my son, which I also describe in the book, which is not just one specific episode that I can recall. And we kind of think of memory as the way of collecting these shiny, special moments, which it also does sometimes, because memory is specialized to capture these things that stand out and are different. But a lot of experiences are quite similar to each other and are still very valuable. And
be very happy memories as well. Mm. So we have to cherish them as well.
So what's going on in my brain? Let's take, for example, a completely specific memory. I don't know.
Your first kiss.
That's a good moment. So when I remember that, when I pluck that off the shelf, is it there waiting or am I having to build it from scratch every time I do that?
Yeah, you have to rebuild that memory every time. But you use some of it is made up of these memory traces. So some of it is stored there, which are not necessarily accurate, but you can build around that and then you can recreate the moment and put in a lot of your kind of, it's not an effortful imagination. It just happens naturally.
The most important thing is what you felt. And that is kind of what makes it stick to your memory, how highly emotional that moment was for you. I'm guessing that it wasn't traumatic.
It was not traumatic.
Or boring.
It was what it was.
Yeah, the worst thing, of course, for memory is if something is boring. If it was a totally boring case, you wouldn't remember it.
So do we deprioritize boredom? And is boredom part of why we forget, or is forgetting another process?
No, and that is actually been demonstrated in the brains of rats just recently by the Moser lab, the ones who got the Nobel Prize for discovering the brain's GPS. They have now discovered the brain's time teller connected to memory. And so they found that actually they could record from this single cell just outside the memory center hippocampus of the rat brain. And when the rat was doing the same thing over and over, they could see that this time teller was just stopped recording because, okay, now things are just being repeated and are boring, then we don't need to make that into a memory. So the brain is doing that as we experience the world. And yeah, so it's fascinating.
Is that sort of a slightly damning concept? Because if you can't remember someone's name or something like that, is that because really your brain has been like, that person's quite boring? You don't need to think about them too much.
No, but that is because names are kind of random sounds, just connected randomly to a person. So it's very strange that there are people that are really good at remembering names. And I met some of them and it's kind of really startling how good they are. But mostly it is natural to not remember when you haven't met someone.
I have a sort of very loose concept in my head that I can't really remember someone's name until like the third time I meet them. Is that a common thing?
That's normal, yes. Yeah. Because the first time you meet someone, you're using your working memory, which is very limited capacity. So you say your name and they say their name and you shake hands and you are filling your working memory up with other stuff, like what are you going to talk about afterwards and how do I appear to this other person, etc. So the name just flies out of your working memory instantly. So it's better to just ask again and say, I didn't quite get your name the first time, what was it? And I think that is, we shouldn't be embarrassed about that. It's natural, and just asking for the name again, it just shows some interest.
Yeah, after writing this book, I understood that It's a separate part of the brain who's solely concerned with remembering people's faces, because it's so important for us to remember faces.
Yeah, I always remember faces, and then you're in that awkward situation if you know the person, but you can't actually introduce them to another person.
Yeah. but I'm very bad at remembering faces and names, so usually I just tell people that right away, and I say, I might not remember you after. It's nothing personal, it's just me.
And what about when we have really unfortunate conditions, like degenerative conditions of the brain, where people can no longer remember? I mean, there's a wide scope of what those conditions are, but generally, is there a process to what's going on biologically there for why those unfortunate things are starting to happen to people, especially in old age?
Yes, especially in Alzheimer's, there is these biological processes going on that start to attack the hippocampus at first, so the memory center where memories are being laid down. So that is why if you meet someone who has kind of not very advanced Alzheimer's, but early stage Alzheimer's, they will remember their childhood and their youth, etc., but they will not remember that you visited last week, for instance. So the new memories are attacked first, and then the disease spreads to other parts of the brain as well, until all old memories are also kind of dissolved. But I want to also stress that memory problems can affect young people as well, and people who have various neurological disorders, like for instance some kinds of epilepsy, and also depression can also really strike out memory and also kind of add on to the burden of depression.
And I have a very small child, and for over two years I never slept properly, and sleep really knocks out your memory. So that is totally normal. Mm. It's not strange to not remember anything, or if you got a D vitamin deficit or B vitamin deficit, or it's several conditions that will affect your memory.
And talk me through some of the sort of stories in the book. I mean, it opens on this experiment of diving in a fjord in Norway. And this is like a recreation of a Scottish experiment that happened in 1975. But you sort of make the case that so many sort of experiments in psychology don't really get repeated, so they can't really be sort of kind of proven as a dead cert. So it's kind of necessary to do these things again. Talk me through what's going on there, and what did you find out when you sort of recreated that experiment?
So we asked some divers to help us recreate this experiment. So all of them went into water and studied a list of random words that they were allowed to see for 2 minutes. And then one group went back on land and tried to recall the words in this safe, ordinary environment. And the other group was asked to just take a small swim underwater and then come back to the same spot where they had memorized. And what we saw was that the divers remembered more words when they recalled underwater, that is, in the same environment as when they studied the words, as compared to back on land.
And the back on land people, one of the guys couldn't remember a word at all.
Yes.
It was totally gone for him. So, and that is extraordinary, considering being underwater with all the oxygen stuff, the gases will affect your ability to remember and your brain, actually. So it should be more difficult to remember underwater with all these things going on with the diving. And still, it was much easier because of all the context that you always have to connect a memory to other memories. That is what you do when you place it in your kind of in your memory. And it's like, we got, what do you call it, a cupboard with a lot of drawers. And the older you get, kind of, because when you're young, you don't have that many kind of drawers to put things in. It's not sorted properly. So you can learn a lot of things, but it's difficult to sort it and to fetch it. But the older, that is something you probably experienced yourself. The older you get, it's easier to put something into your already existing contexts.
Yeah,
that's the positive part of growing older, that you get more experienced and you can
get more developed
memory networks that you can place things in.
It's much easier to place something that you already are kind of half familiar with. You can easily place it into something. I started to knit this year. I never knitted before. It's very, very difficult. But I learned to knit very advanced knitting.
A memory and learning the same?
Yeah, of course it is.
Yeah, but but she's talking about knitting, which is implicit memory, so that we have different memory systems.
Right.
And muscle so learning, memory. So yeah, we could call that motoric memory or muscle memory. But
you don't know how intellectual it is.
Yes, it's
you don't
very
knit. Well, it's on a very high philosophical level of knitting.
And one of the sort of standout examples of processing memory in the book is you visit the island of Utoya with one of the survivors of that massacre. Talk me through what you were hoping to achieve with that visit and what were you trying to learn about the processing of memory by doing that?
So we talked to Adrian, who survived. So he was shot on Utøya. So first we interviewed him and he talked us through his memories and how his memories are affecting him on a daily basis. And it was actually he who suggested that we should go out there and he could show us the place where it happened. And in a way, that also helped us visualize it more closely. Of course, it was a very strange experience being there and seeing, he pointed out the place where he was shot, and for him it was kind of a way of going through and
processing
memories. Yeah, he does that sometimes. But now the island is taken back by this youth organization and they are having these idyllic summer camps again. So when we were there it was spring and almost no people there and just the spring flowers and this strange memory tour through Adrian's traumatic memories.
But yeah, it is possible to kind of change all the memories in a place like that. And Adrian too is kind of trying to change the things he's been through to something positive. So he's been studying peace studies and he wants to be a researcher working with terrorism. And he's been to Oxford for a year now, so he's kind of doing really well fighting these memories still.
And I mean, collective memory is a completely different sort of concept, isn't it? I mean, how society remembers things together. I mean, is that sort of something that you can academically pin down, or is that a much more sort of just social kind of question?
No, it was difficult. We discussed it because I'm educated and a historian. So what my field of expertise is collective memories. That is how it happens that we have history at all. We tell the story together. That is how it's preserved. But after writing the book, I was thinking of kind of, we are kind of examining the individual memory in this book, and that had to be kind of the framework for the book, otherwise it would be too big. And collective memory is that then we're moving into a whole other area, which is the things that I've been studying for a lot of years. But I've been thinking of how some of the things like false memories and also kind of how unreliable memories are, that in a way, the things we are writing about in the book is how memories are very unreliable and that they even can be false memories. And in that respect, we need each other. We need each other to correct our memories, to double check things, to make the stories together. So it's all about that kind of. So we shouldn't stay too much in our own head. We should share the stories. Yeah, try to find the truth in them, I think.
Hilda and Ylva Österbu there speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. And Adventures in Memory, the Science and Secrets of Remembering and Forgetting is out now.
Choreographer Rosie Kay isn't afraid to deal with difficult themes. Her critically acclaimed work has seen her use dance as a lens to examine the experience of soldiers on the front line of the British Army. She also took on the daunting task of choreographing the handover ceremony at this year's Commonwealth Games, watched by an estimated billion people worldwide. Adam Curtis, meanwhile, will be familiar to documentary fans of all shapes and stripes. In films like Hypernormalization and Bitter Lake, he set out to dismantle and re-examine established historical narratives.
The performance, named after the CIA's apparently top-secret attempts to achieve mind-control techniques over everyone from Soviet spies to Britney Spears, looks at how conspiracy theories are influencing entertainment and politics today, and asks why young people are becoming ever more disengaged from mainstream debate, embracing fantasy and half-truths instead. Augustine spoke to Rosie Kay and Adam Curtis about MKUltra earlier.
The show MKUltra is the third part of a trilogy that was meant to be about things that terrified me, I suppose. So the first part, I looked at the body and war, which became Five Soldiers. The second part, I looked at religion and evoking religious states with the body. It became a show called There Is Hope. And this third part was meant to be about politics. But as I kind of dug deeper and deeper into politics, I got into surveillance, what was happening with Snowden, what was happening around technologies. And that took me down a spiral into conspiracy theories. We're talking around sort of 2013, around then. And I was seeing that there was this huge amount of analysis of news stories to sort of prove they were fake. And I found that really interesting, but I couldn't really work out how to do that and make a dance about that. And it was when I stumbled upon the conspiracy theory that pop stars were being brainwashed through a real CIA-sponsored brainwashing program that was real but was stopped in the 70s called MKUltra, that I started to think that there was something really interesting about this conspiracy theory that pop stars were somehow being used by the New World Order to spread satanic, occult or various different messages through pop stars, pop music, their behaviour and their dance routines. And I thought that was a way of confronting politics, contemporary society, I suppose, modern tribes in a way, but through the medium of the body. So that's what got me started on MKUltra. I was telling this to the dance critic and now rather famous author Luke Jennings, and he said, "Oh, you must speak to Adam Curtis. He'd be very interesting to talk to." So actually it took me quite a while to get hold of Adam, and I think he thought I was pestering him, and we met for a coffee. And by this stage, I was kind of quite clear about what I wanted to do. When I told Adam about the conspiracy theory with the pop stars, he burst out laughing and I think realised that I wasn't talking about 9/11 or JFK. I was talking about something else, and said he'd really like to collaborate with me. So that began the journey together, really.
Adam, what was it for you about this kind of pitch that piqued your interest?
I don't think she was really pitching to me. She was telling me something quite interesting, which I thought, I mean, what Rosie was saying to me was, what I'm interested in is why people believe such strange, absurd conspiracies, born out of little bits of fragments of truth, but then turned into sort of giant, weird dreams. And she wanted to know why. Why do people believe this? Not whether they're true or not, just why are they so big at the moment? And I think that's a very, very interesting question. I like the idea that she was trying to approach it not through a normal journalistic way, but through dance, which I knew nothing about, still know nothing about. But I like that idea because I think so much journalism and so much we're reporting of the whole world at the moment is so cliched. And you know exactly what they're going to say within minutes. To actually approach it from a completely other angle through dance, I just thought it would be fresh. So, yeah, I said yes.
In doing that then, Rosie, in approaching this kind of strange dream state that culture has kind of entered and trying to work things out about it through dance, could you talk a bit about how, as a process, you know, from the composing the choreography through rehearsals to the show itself, how that kind of unfolds and what kind of conclusions or ideas you personally are able to draw out of it?
Well, actually, it goes back a bit further before I even get into the studio making it. I did go and work with a lot of young people and tried to not go in with a conspiracy theory agenda, but waited to see if it came up. And every time I talked to them, young people from about the age of sort of 12 up to 25, they all talked about the Illuminati and they could all decode this massive amount of quite complex symbolism that's within the pop music videos and the sort of idioms that they use within the symbolism. I actually got them to start making dances about this. And that threw up really surprising and interesting ways that we could take this stuff that they were being bombarded with, but I sort of subvert it. And I thought, yes, there's an interesting dance language here. I then started working with dancers and giving them lots of tasks and looking at lots of pop videos, but I wasn't getting what I wanted. It either became a pastiche of a pop video or it was unidentifiable and it became very contemporary dance. So I went away on my own. I watched hundreds of videos and then I started quite precisely improvising to certain trap music tracks that have this really intense driven beat. And what came out of my own body was really odd. I don't particularly go on stage much anymore myself and perform, but I was a performer for 20 years and I'm trained in contemporary and ballet and street and hip hop and all sorts of styles. And I had this really weird way of moving and mashing up all these languages with a narrative inside the dance. So I filmed all these little dances of myself and then gave that to the company. Each dancer had their own small video they had to learn, as well as group videos. And it was incredibly complex material. So coming back to the show this year, actually, we had to reanalyze quite a lot of the material and again find much more layers of complexity, and I could find more layers of what I was trying to say in that movement. And so in a way, all my dancers, the seven dancers, became my puppets. So even in the process of making it, I became the kind of the puppeteer controlling my automatons on stage. And that relates very much to this idea that the pop stars are automatons, and maybe, in fact, we're all automatons. We're kind of being manipulated. I guess that's the idea, really.
That's certainly how it feels as well. One thing that sort of struck me is that this language of conspiracy theorising has a much more established and increasingly a much more pernicious kind of tradition in the US than it does in the UK. And I could be wrong, but generally it seems to be a reaction to something in the US cultural psyche. Is this global culture that you're kind of exploring, do you think, or is this American culture?
Well, you're right in that there's something kind of quite specific about America and American culture. And as I sort of dug down, you've got to remember that America is a really young country, and its mythology and its legends are, whether you look at Scientology or the Mormons, a lot of their spirituality is a little bit kind of quite odd to us and relates to sci-fi. There's something about the Pilgrim Fathers mythology linking with the Amerindian mythologies, linking with slave culture, that does, I think, create a fervent hotbed of quite odd ideas. So maybe there's more of a sort of a fertile ground for these ideas to thrive and suddenly sprout and grow and become almost like new religions. I think the way it's being used in the States right now is has been hijacked by the alt-right. And when you dig down deep enough into any of these conspiracy theories, it becomes rather nasty, very right-wing and very anti-Semitic. And so that is my danger point of this is not just fun and games looking at this. This is a dark heart, and Trump knows it and he's using it and manipulating it. So I think what America does affects us. The way that American culture has been used and changed from when I grew up, how we felt about American culture with Back to the Future and MTV, how now that is dominating us in a very different way. This matters to world culture.
Adam, if I could just ask you, you've said that social media and the role it played has been overstated. I wanted to ask about that with reference to the kind of entrenchment of conspiracy theories in the kind of mainstream cultural psyche. Alex Jones was recently thrown off Twitter, and it seems to have had some sort of impact in terms of his kind of, and this is an annoying phrase, sort of no platforming. And I just wondered if, you know, if you do still think, or if you do think at all, that there is no relationship between social media platforms and the infiltration of these.
I don't think
ideas.
I said that.
Did no, you not?
Sorry. I mean, normally I would be.
No,
I'd
that's
agree
quite
happily
right.
with you, but I don't think I ever said that. I mean, what I, in the films I've made recently, what I've argued is that social media tends to isolate people who think like each other into a sort of strange, simplified world where they all agree with each other and groom each other, and anyone who doesn't agree gets booted out. And I think that simplification has led to an expansion of sort of weird, strange stories.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the thing about social media does exactly, in a way, what Rosie is talking about also with the idea of automatons, is that, and I think this is really what this dance piece is trying to get at underneath, is that in an age when we look at machines as sort of magical, which we do, what's happening is that we are sort of being both simplified and turned into sort of quite simplified machine-like creatures in order to fit into those systems. It's not a conspiracy. It's just what happens when a piece of something, in this case a technology, becomes the sort of dominant myth of our time. So you get a lot of people writing books saying the robots are going to take over. I don't think that's what's really happening. I think what's happening is that gently we're being simplified, smoothed down in our reactions to everything, so we become almost robot-like in our behaviours, which makes us very easy to corral into social media bubbles. So it says, if you like this, then why don't you go to this bubble? If you like that, why don't you go to that bubble? And we rather obediently all go that way. And in that sense, I think social media, it's become a system of management rather than a system of actually distributing information across lots of different groups. It manages people within its own stories. And in that sense, I think it's a limiting thing. And maybe that's what you thought I was saying.
I was sorry, I just found what I was referring to. And it was more about the power of advertising forces used through Facebook platform, which...
Oh, that's a different question, which is a fascinating question. Is Google a total scam?
Which is something that I've been thinking about a lot. I haven't seen any data.
If you talk to people in advertising,
yeah,
they're beginning to question whether Google's ads, which is a monopoly, mm-hmm, have any real effect. Because actually what they're not like old advertising. They're very sort of, they're stuck in the past. They notice that if you've booked a ticket to Belgrade, they'll offer you tickets to Belgrade for the next 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. That's nothing. It's pointless. And what advertising people are gently, quietly beginning to say is it all a scam? Are they actually conning us that these ads have any effect? Because there's no real evidence. And I think that might be the next thing on, which is not that Facebook and Google are these dark forces that can manipulate you, that they actually might just be a giant piece of snake oil, a con, where a wonderful piece of technology, the internet, which could distribute information and could lead to an opening up of democracy, has been co-opted by about 5 or 6 big dragons, as the Chinese call them, and is shut down and is now being used as a way of actually corralling us into sort of managed bubbles in which we invent weird little stories, the sort of thing that Rosie was talking about. And whereas actually the truth is, we might all be being conned by Google. And in the process, journalism gets destroyed, and what you'll get left with is just this sort of, you live in the world of a fake advertising.
Mm. But I suppose there is a point at which these two things intersect, which is the sort of smooth, atomised bubbles where people go to hear their kind of confirmation biases reconfirmed, and the targeted adverts that, you know, according to sort of journalists like Carol Cadwallader, played a really significant part in the 2016 populist movement.
Well, I always worry that maybe that's another conspiracy theory, because maybe she's actually feeding the very thing that I think's the con. Because what's implicit in that is that, oh, Facebook is really dark. It can manipulate everything. The trouble with that argument is there's no proof. It may well happen. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but you can't prove it. There's no way that you can prove whether Trump won the election because of Russian interference or not. It's impossible to prove. Therefore, it becomes a swamp in which all sorts of strange dreams and fantasies, like the sort of thing that Rosie was talking about, have now grown up. And what's really interesting about our time is that Rosie and I started doing this show 18 months ago, Rosie? Something like that.
Yeah.
In that time, the sort of people who would 18 months ago have scoffed at the idea of conspiracies, the sort of metropolitan rational liberals, they now all believe in conspiracies. They believe that Russia is in control of everything. They believe that Russia gave you Brexit. Now, I'm not saying it didn't, but you can't prove it. So in a way, they've slipped in to the very world that 18 months ago they'd have scoffed at. And I think that's what we're trying to get at in this piece, is that in an age when people are very uncertain and there's no real sort of benchmark for this is what we want out of society, everything slips into a sort of miasma, and as what you said earlier on, it's a dream world. And I think that's the thing that characterises our time. And what's really good about this show is it evokes that dream world very well and very precisely and beautifully.
Adam Curtis and Rosie Kay, they're discussing their production MK Ultra with Augustin Matilari. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly. Well, that's all for this edition, 488 of The Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall and Augustin Matilari. Our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Markus Hippi.
And from me, Augustin Matilari. Goodbye.
Bye.